All the same, she suddenly wanted to talk to Jim Gardner. Needed to talk to him. She went in to call his place up the road in Unity. She had dialed four numbers when she remembered he was off doing readings. Those and the poetry workshops were the way he supported himself. For itinerant artists, summer was prime time. All those menopausal matrons have to do something with their summers, she could hear Jim saying ironically. And I have to eat in the winter. One hand washes the other. You ought to thank God you're saved the reading circuit anyway, Bobby. Yes, she was saved that. Although she thought Jim liked it more than he let on. Certainly did get laid enough. Anderson put the phone back in the cradle and looked at the bookcase to the left of the stove. It wasn't a handsome bookcase. She was no one's carpenter, nor ever would be. But it served a purpose. The bottom two shelves were taken up by the Time Life series of volumes on the Old West. The two shelves above were filled with a mixture of fiction and fact on that same subject. Brian Garfield's early westerns jostled for place with Hubert Hampton's massive Western Territories Examined. Louis L'Amour's Sackett saga lay cheek by jowl with Richard Marius' wonderful two novels, The Coming of Rain and Bound for the Promised Land. J.R. Nash's Blood Letters and Bad Men and Richard F.K. Mudgett's Westward Expansion bracketed a riot of paperback westerns by Ray Hogan, Archie Jocelyn, Max Brand, Ernest Haycox, and, of course, Zane Grey. Anderson's copy of Riders of the Purple Sage had been read nearly to tatters. On the top shelf were her own books, 11 of them. 10 were westerns, beginning with Hangtown, published in 1975, and ending with The Long Ride Back, published in 86. Massacre Canyon, the new one, would be published in September, as all of her westerns had been since the beginning. It occurred to her now that she had been here, in Haven, when she had received her first copy of Hangtown, although she'd begun the novel in the room of a scuzzy Cleves Mills apartment on a 30s vintage Underwood dying of old age. Still, she'd finished here, and it was here that she'd held the first actual copy of the book in her hands. Here, in Haven. Her entire career as a publishing writer was here, except for the first book. She took that down now and looked at it curiously, realizing it had been perhaps 5 years since she had last held this slim volume in her hands. It was not only depressing to realize how fast time got by, it was depressing to think of how often she thought about that lately. This volume was a total contrast to the others, with their jackets showing maces and buttes, riders and cows and dusty trail-drive towns. This jacket was a 19th-century woodcut of a clipper ship quartering toward land. Its uncompromising blacks and whites were startling, almost shocking. Boxing the Compass was the title printed above the woodcut. And below it, Poems by Roberta Anderson. She opened the book, paging past the title, musing for a moment over the copyright date, 1974, then pausing at the dedication page. It was as stark as the woodcut. This book is for James Gardner, the man she had been trying to call, the second of the only three men she had ever had sex with, and the only one who had ever been able to bring her to orgasm. Not that she attached any special importance to that, or not much, anyway. Or so she thought, or thought she thought, or something. And it didn't matter anyway. Those days were also old days. She sighed and put the book back on the shelf without looking at the poems. Only one of them was much good. That one had been written in March of 1972, a month after her grandfather died of cancer. The rest of them were crap. The casual reader might have been fooled because she was a talented writer. But the heart of her talent had been somewhere else. When she had published Hangtown, the circle of writers she had known had all denied her, all except Jim, who had published Boxing the Compass in the first place. She had dropped Sherry Fenderson a long, chatty letter not long after coming to Haven and had received a curt postcard in return. Please don't write me anymore. I don't know you. Signed with a single slashed S as curt as the message. She had been sitting on the porch, crying over that card when Jim showed up. "Why are you crying over what that silly woman thinks?" he had asked her. Do you really want to trust the judgment of a woman who goes around yelling power to the people and smelling of Chanel No. 5? She just happens to be a very good poet. She had sniffled. Jim gestured impatiently. That doesn't make her any older, he had said, or any more able to recant the cant she's been taught and then taught herself. Get your mind right, Bobby. If you want to go on doing what you like, get your fucking mind right and stop that fucking crying. That fucking crying makes me sick. That fucking crying makes me want to puke. You're not weak. I know weak when I'm with it. Why do you want to be something you're not? Your sister? Is that why? She's not here, and she's not you, and you don't have to let her in if you don't want to. Don't whine to me about your sister anymore. Grow up. Stop bitching. She'd looked at him, she remembered now, amazed. There's a big difference between being good at what you do and being smart about what you know, he said. Give Sherry some time to grow up. Give yourself some time to grow up and stop being your own jury. It's boring. I don't want to listen to you snivel. Sniveling is for jerks. Quit being a jerk. She had felt herself hating him, loving him, wanting all of him and none of him. Did he say he knew weak when he was with it? Boy, he ought to. He was bent. She knew it even then. Now, he had said, you want to lay an ex-publisher, or do you want to cry all over that stupid postcard? She had laid him. She didn't know now and hadn't known then if she wanted to lay him, but she had, and screamed when she came. That had been near the end. She remembered that, too, how it had been near the end. He had gotten married not long after, but it would have been near the end anyway. He was weak, and he was bent. Doesn't matter anyway, she thought, and gave herself the old good advice. Let it go. Advice easier given than followed. It was a long time before Anderson got over into sleep that night. Old ghosts had stirred when she moved her book of undergraduate poems. Or perhaps it was that high, mild wind, hooting the eaves and whistling the trees. She had almost made it when Peter woke her up. Peter was howling in his sleep. Anderson got up in a hurry, scared. Peter had made a lot of noises in his sleep before this, not to mention some unbelievably noxious dog parts, but he had never howled. It was like waking to the sound of a child screaming in the grip of a nightmare. She went into the living room, naked except for her socks, and knelt by Peter, who was still on the rug by the stove. Pete, she muttered. Hey, Pete, cool it. She stroked the dog. Peter was shivering and jerked away when Anderson touched him, burying the eroded remains of his teeth. Then his eyes opened, the bad one and the good one, and he seemed to come back to himself. He whined weakly and thumped his tail against the floor. You all right? Anderson asked. Peter licked her hand. Then lie down again. Stop whining. It's boring. Stop fucking off. Peter lay down and closed his eyes. Anderson knelt, looking at him, troubled. He's dreaming of that thing. Her rational mind rejected that, but the night insisted on its own imperative. It was true, and she knew it. She went to bed at last, and sleep came sometime after 2 a.m. She had a peculiar dream. In it, she was groping in the dark, not trying to find something, but to get away from something. She was in the woods. Branches whipped into her face and poked her arms. Sometimes she stumbled over roots and fallen trees. And then, ahead of her, a terrible green light shone out in a single pencil-like ray. In her dream, she thought of Poe's The Telltale Heart, the mad narrator's lantern, muffled up except for one tiny hole, which he used to direct a beam of light onto the evil eye he fancied his elderly benefactor possessed. Bobby Anderson felt her teeth fall out. They went painlessly, all of them. The bottom ones tumbled, some outward, some back into her mouth, where they lay on her tongue or under it in hard little lumps. The top one simply dropped down the front of her blouse. She felt one catch in her bra, which clasped in front, poking her skin. The light. The green light. The light. 5. was wrong. It wasn't just that it was gray and pearly, that light. It was expected that such a wind as had blown up the night before would bring a change in the weather. But Anderson knew there was something more than that wrong, even before she looked at the clock on the nightstand. She picked it up in both hands and drew it close to her face, although her vision was a perfect 20/20. It was 3:15 in the afternoon. She had gone to sleep late, given, but no matter how late she slept, either habit or the need to urinate always woke her up by 9 o'clock, 10 at the latest. But she had slept a full 12 hours, and she was ravenous. She shuffled out into the living room, still wearing only her socks, and saw that Peter was lying limply on his side, head back, yellow stubs of teeth showing, legs splayed out. Dead, she thought with a cold and absolute certainty. Peter's dead. Died in the night. She went to her dog, already anticipating the feel of cold flesh and lifeless fur. Then Peter uttered a muzzy, lip-flapping sound, a blurry dog snore. Anderson felt huge relief course through her. She spoke the dog's name aloud, and Peter started up, almost guiltily, as if he was also aware of oversleeping. Anderson supposed he was. Dogs seemed to have an acutely developed sense of time. "We slept late, fella," she said. Peter got up and stretched first one hind leg and then the other. He looked around, almost comically perplexed, and then went to the door. Anderson opened it. Peter stood there for a moment, not liking the rain. Then he went out to do his business. Anderson stood in the living room a moment longer, still marveling over her certainty that Peter had been dead. Just what in hell was wrong with her lately? Everything was doom and gloom. Then she headed for the kitchen to fix a meal, whatever you call breakfast at 3 in the afternoon. On the way, she diverted into the bathroom to do her own business. Then she paused in front of her reflection in the toothpaste-spotted mirror. A woman pushing 40. Graying hair, otherwise not too bad. She didn't drink much, didn't smoke much, spent most of her time outside when she wasn't riding. Irish black hair, no romance novel blaze of red for her. Rather too long. Gray-blue eyes. Abruptly, she bared her teeth, expecting for just a moment to see only smooth pink gums. But her teeth were there. All of them. Thank the fluoridated water in Utica, New York, for that. She touched them, let her fingers prove their bony reality to her brain. But something wasn't right. Wetness. There was wetness on her upper thighs. Oh, no. Oh, shit. This is almost a week early. I just put clean sheets on the bed yesterday. But after she had showered, put a pad and a fresh pair of cotton panties, and pulled the whole work snug, she checked the sheets and saw them unmarked. Her period was early, but it had at least had the consideration to wait until she was almost awake. And there was no cause for alarm. She was fairly regular, but she had been both early and late from time to time. Maybe diet. Maybe subconscious stress. Maybe some internal clock slipping a cog or two. She had no urge to grow old fast, but she often thought that having the whole inconvenient business of menstruation behind her would be a relief. The last of her nightmares slipped away, and Bobby Anderson went in to fix herself a very late breakfast. Chapter 2. Anderson Digs. 1. It rained steadily for the next 3 days. Anderson wandered restlessly around the house, made a trip with Peter into Augusta in the pickup for supplies she didn't really need, drank beer and listened to old Beach Boys tunes while she made repairs around the house. Trouble was, there weren't really that many repairs that needed to be done. By the 3rd day, she was circling the typewriter, thinking maybe she would start the new book. She knew what it was supposed to be about. A young schoolmarm and a buffalo hunter caught up in a range war in Kansas during the early 1850s, a period when everyone in the midsection of the country seemed to be tuning up for the Civil War, whether they knew it or not. It would be a good book, she thought, but she didn't think it was quite ready yet, whatever that meant. A sardonic mimic awoke in her mind, doing an Orson Welles voice, "We will write no odor before it's time." Still, her restlessness dug at her, and the signs were all there, an impatience with books, with the music, with herself, a tendency to drift off. And then she would be looking at the typewriter, wanting to wake it into some dream. Peter also seemed restless, scratching at the door to go out and then scratching at it to come back in 5 minutes later, wandering around the place, lying down, then getting up again. Low barometer, Anderson thought. That's all it is. Makes us both restless. Cranky. And her damn period. Usually she flowed heavy and then just stopped, like turning off a faucet. This time she just went on leaking. Bad washer, ha ha, she thought, with no humor at all. She found herself sitting in front of the typewriter just after dark on the second rainy day, a blank sheet rolled into the carriage. She started to type, and what came out was a bunch of X's and O's, like a kid's tic-tac-toe game, and then something that looked like a mathematical equation, which was stupid since the last math she'd taken was Algebra 2 in high school. These days, X was for crossing out the wrong word, and that was all. She pulled the blank sheet out and tossed it away. After lunch on the third rainy day, she called the English department at the university. Jim no longer taught there, not for 8 years, but he still had friends on the faculty and kept in touch. Muriel in the office usually knew where he was, and did this time. Jim Gardner, she told Anderson, was doing a reading in Fall River that night, June 24th, followed by two in Boston over the next 3 nights, followed by readings and lectures in Providence and New Haven, all part of something called the New England Poetry Caravan. Must be Patricia McCardle, Anderson thought, smiling a little. So he'd be back when, 4th of July? Gee, I don't know when he'll be back, Bobby, Muriel said. You know Jim. His last reading's June 30th, that's all I can say for sure. Anderson thanked her and hung up. She looked at the phone thoughtfully, calling up Muriel fully in her mind. Another Irish Colleen, but Muriel had the expected red hair. Just now reaching the far edge of her prime. Round-faced, green-eyed, full-breasted. Had she slept with Jim? Probably. Anderson felt a spark of jealousy, but not much of a spark. Muriel was okay. Just speaking to Muriel made her feel better. Someone who knew who she was, who could think of her as a real person, not just as a customer on the other side of the counter in an Augusta hardware store, or as someone to say how do to over the mailbox. She was solitary by nature, but not monastic, and sometimes simple human contact had a way of fulfilling her when she didn't even know she needed to be fulfilled. And she supposed she knew now why she had wanted to get in contact with Jim. Talking with Muriel had done that, at least. The thing in the woods had stayed on her mind, and the idea that it was some sort of clandestine coffin had grown to a certainty. It wasn't writing she was restless to do. It was digging. She just hadn't wanted to do it on her own. "Looks like I'll have to, though, Pete," she said, sitting down in her rocker by the east window, her reading chair. Peter glanced at her briefly as if to say, "Whatever you want, babe." Anderson sat forward, suddenly looking at Pete, really looking at him. Peter looked back cheerfully enough, tail thumping on the floor. For a moment it seemed there was something different about Peter, something so obvious she should be seeing it. If so, she wasn't. She settled back, opening her book, a master's thesis from the University of Nebraska. The most exciting thing about it, the title, Range War and Civil War. She remembered thinking a couple of nights ago, as her sister Anne would think, "You're getting as funny in the head as Uncle Frank, Bobby." Well, maybe. Shortly, she was deep into the thesis, making an occasional note on the legal pad she kept near. Outside, the rain continued to fall. 2. The following day dawned clear and bright and flawless, a postcard summer day with just enough breeze to make the bugs keep their distance. Anderson pottered around the house until almost 10 o'clock, conscious of the growing pressure her mind was putting on her to get out there and dig it up already. She could feel herself consciously pushing back against that urge. Orson Welles again. "We will dig up nobody before it's..." Oh, shut up, Orson. Her days of simply following the urge of the moment, a lifestyle that had once been catechized by the bald motto, "If it feels good, do it," were over. It had never worked well for her, that philosophy. In fact, almost every bad thing that had happened to her had its roots in some impulsive action. She attached no moral stigma to people who did live their lives according to impulse. Maybe her intuitions just hadn't been that good. She ate a big breakfast, added a scrambled egg to Peter's gravy train. Peter ate with more appetite than usual, and Anderson put it down to the end of the rainy spell, and then did the washing up. If her dribbles would just stop, everything would be fine. Forget it. We will stop no period before it's time. Right, Orson? You're fucking A. Bobby went outside, clapped an old straw cowboy hat on her head, and spent the next hour in the garden. Things out there were looking better than they had any right to, given the rain. The peas were coming on, and the corn was rearing up good, as Uncle Frank would have said. She quit at 11. Fuck it. She went around the house to the shed, got the spade and shovel, paused, and added a crowbar. She started out of the shed, went back, and took a screwdriver and an adjustable wrench from the toolbox. Peter started out with her, as he always did, but this time Anderson said, "No, Peter," and pointed back at the house. Peter stopped, looking wounded. He whined and took a tentative step toward Anderson. "No, Peter." Peter gave in and headed back, head down, tail drooping dispiritedly. Anderson was sorry to see him go that way, but Peter's previous reaction to the plate in the ground had been bad. She stood a moment longer on the path which would lead her to the woods road, spade in one hand, shovel and crowbar in the other, watching as Peter mounted the back steps, nosed open the back door, and went into the house. She thought, something was different about him. Is different about him. What is it? She didn't know. But for a moment, almost subliminally, her dream flickered back to her, that arrow of poisonous green light, and her teeth all falling painlessly out of her gums. Then it was gone, and she set off toward the place where it was, that odd thing in the ground, listening to the crickets make their steady ree-ree-ree sound in this small back field, which would soon be ready for its first cutting. 3. At 3 that afternoon, it was Peter who raised her from the semi-daze in which she had been working, making her aware she was two damn near starving and damn near exhausted. Peter was howling. The sound raised goose flesh on Anderson's back and arms. She dropped the shovel she had been using and backed away from the thing in the earth. The thing that was no plate, no box, not anything she could understand. All she knew for sure was that she had fallen into a strange, thoughtless state she didn't like at all. This time she had done more than lose track of time. She felt as if she had lost track of herself. It was as if someone else had stepped into her head the way a man would step into a bulldozer or a payloader, simply firing her up and starting to yank the right levers. Peter howled, nose pointing toward the sky, long, chilling, mournful sounds. "Stop it, Peter!" Anderson yelled, and thankfully Peter did. Any more of that, and she might simply have turned and run. Instead, she fought for control and got it. She backed up another step and cried out when something flapped loosely against her back. At her cry, Peter uttered one more short, yipping sound and fell silent again. Anderson grabbed for whatever had touched her, thinking it might be... Well, she didn't know what she thought it might be. But even before her hand closed on it, she remembered what it was. She had a hazy memory of stopping just long enough to hang her blouse on a bush. Here it was. She took it and put it on, getting the buttons wrong on the first try so that one tail hung down below the other. She rebuttoned it, looking at the dig she had begun, and now that archaeological word seemed to fit what she was doing exactly. Her memories of the 4.5 hours she'd spent digging were like her memory of hanging her blouse on the bush. Hazy and broken. They were not memories, they were fragments. But now, looking at what she had done, she felt awe as well as fear, and a mounting sense of excitement. Whatever it was huge. Not just big, but huge. The spade, shovel, and crowbar lay at intervals along a 15-foot trench in the forest floor. She had made neat piles of black earth and chunks of rock at regular intervals, sticking up from this trench, which was about 4 feet deep at the point where Anderson had originally stumbled over 3 inches of protruding gray metal, was the leading edge of some titanic object. Gray metal. Some object. You'd ordinarily have a right to expect something better, more specific, from a writer, she thought, arming sweat from her forehead. But she was no longer sure the metal was steel. She thought now it might be a more exotic alloy, beryllium, magnesium, perhaps. And composition aside, she had absolutely no idea what it was. She began to unbutton her jeans so she could tuck in her blouse, then paused. The crotch of the faded Levi's was soaked with blood. Jesus. Jesus Christ, this isn't a period, this is Niagara Falls. She was momentarily frightened, really frightened, then told herself to quit being a ninny. She had gone into some sort of daze and done digging a crew of 4 husky men could have been proud of, her, a woman who went 125, maybe 130, tops. Of course she was flowing heavily. She was fine. In fact, should be grateful she wasn't cramping as well as gushing. My, how poetic we are today, Bobby, she thought, and uttered a harsh little laugh. All she really needed was to clean herself up. A shower and a change would do fine. The jeans had been ready for either the trash or the rag bag anyway. Now there was one less worry in a troubled, confusing world, right? Right. No big deal. She buttoned her pants again, not tucking the blouse in. No sense ruining that as well, although God knew it wasn't exactly a Dior original. The feel of the sticky wetness down there when she moved made her grimace. God, she wanted to get cleaned up. In a hurry. But instead of starting up the slope to the path, she walked back toward the thing in the earth again, drawn to it. Peter howled, and the goose flesh reappeared again. Peter, will you for Christ's sake shut up? She hardly ever shouted at Pete, really shouted at him, but the goddamn mutt was starting to make her feel like a behavioral psychology subject. Goose flesh when the dog howled instead of saliva at the sound of the bell, but the same principle. Standing close to her find, she forgot about Peter and only stared wonderingly at it. After some moments, she reached out and gripped it. Again, she felt that curious sense of vibration. It sank into her hand and then disappeared. This time, she thought of touching a hull beneath which very heavy machinery is hard at work. The metal itself was so smooth that it had an almost greasy texture. You expected some of it to come off on your hands. She made a fist and wrapped her knuckles on it. It made a dull sound, like a fist rapping on a thick chunk of mahogany. She stood a moment longer, then took the screwdriver from her back pocket, held it indecisively for a moment, and then, feeling oddly guilty, feeling like a vandal, she drew the blade down the exposed metal. It wouldn't scratch. Her eye suggested 2 further things, but either or both could have been an optical illusion. The first was that the metal seemed to grow slightly thicker as it went from its edge to the point where it disappeared into the earth. The second was that the edge was slightly curved. These 2 things, if true, suggested an idea that was at once exciting, ludicrous, frightening, impossible, and possessed of a certain mad logic. She ran her palm over the smooth metal, then stepped away. What the hell was she doing petting this goddamn thing while the blood was running down her legs? And her period was the least of her concerns if what she was starting to think just might turn out to be the truth. You better call somebody, Bobby. Right now. I'll call Jim when he gets back. Sure. Call a poet. Great idea. And you can call the Reverend Moon, maybe Edward Gorey and Gayon Wilson to draw pictures. And you can hire a few rock bands and have fucking Woodstock 1988 out here. Get serious, Bobby. Call the state police. No. I want to talk to Jim first. Want him to see it. Want to talk to him about it. Meantime, I'll dig around it some more. It could be dangerous. Yes. Not only could be, probably was. Hadn't she felt that? Hadn't Peter felt it? There was something else, too. Coming down the slope from the path this morning, she had found a dead woodchuck, had almost stepped on it. Although the smell, when she bent over the animal, told her it had been dead 2 days at least, there had been no buzz of flies to warn her. There were no flies at all around old Chuck, and Anderson could not remember ever having seen such a thing. There was no obvious sign of what had killed it, either. But believing that thing in the ground had had anything to do with it was bullshit of the purest ray serene. Old Chuck had probably gotten some farmer's poison bait and stumbled out here to die. Go home. Change your pants. You're bloody and you stink.